Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster, part of the Nerd Party Network. I'm your host for today's episode, Lee Hutchison, and I'm joined by, once again, another amazing special guest. Today I'm joined on the pod phone by Madeline Woolner. Madeline is a young Hollywood actress, and she's already starred with some amazing people, and she's starred in one of my favourite movies of the past few years, The Neon Demon. I sat down to talk with Madeline, and she told me what it's like to work with people like Nicholas Winding Refn, Nicole Kidman, Bryan Cranston, John Travolta, Will Arnett, Elle Fanning, and Stephen Tobolowsky. I hope you'll join both of us for the next 45 minutes as we talk about her experiences in Hollywood and the types of movies, roles, and projects she's got lined up. I hope you enjoy the podcast, and I'd really appreciate it if you could leave a 5-star review on iTunes. It really makes a huge difference, so it's not just you guys hearing these interviews, it's people that are searching for these kind of things on the internet as well. It really can make a difference, and hopefully we can keep the show growing and kind of getting even more people coming onto the show to tell us their amazing stories to me and to you, the listeners. Thank you very much, and enjoy the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining me today, Madeline. How are you in LA, I assume?
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Yeah, I'm in LA. It's a sunny, beautiful day. And you're in Edinburgh, right?
Yeah, good old Edinburgh in Scotland.
Yeah, but Scotland's fantastic. You guys just had your Fringe.
Yeah, it finishes up tomorrow, actually. So, yeah, it's been a pretty exciting Fringe. I moved flat, so I haven't had much chance to actually view many shows this Fringe, so it's been a bit of a frustrating one. Have you ever done the Fringe yourself?
Oh, not yours over there. We had the, when I was in New Orleans, I had started an immersive Shakespeare performance group with my friend Julie, and we were supposed to do the New Orleans Fringe, which is so fun because New Orleans is so crazy. But then I got into Lambda, and so I had to leave like 2 weeks before the Fringe.
Okay.
I missed it.
Yeah, it sounds, how did you kind of kickstart something like that? What is like the kind of American reaction to say something like kind of a Shakespeare kind of theater play?
When you say damn the redcoats, get them out of here.
Yeah.
You know, it's so interesting because like, so I studied at Lambda, which is all classical theater, and it's all like true to form, and you're working with people who just respect the text, and it's all about voice and physicality, and then people are in, I mean, people in the UK are going to Shakespeare, and you, like, you guys all take your, what are your oral exams that you have to do?
Kind of like English and drama, yeah, sort of, we'll read Romeo and Juliet in classrooms, and yeah, like, it always seems to be a bit of a staple of the English language here.
Yeah, exactly, and for some reason, it's just so poorly taught in America because it's so much of like, oh, and you have to do Shakespeare. And so there's not the understanding and fondness that I think is bred from a really young age over there. And so it's also crazy because you go to see Shakespeare here because a lot of community theaters will do it because obviously it's, you know, common property now. And so you don't have to get the rights for the play. And people don't know what they're saying on stage. And so because of that, when people are taken to theater as a young age, they don't like Shakespeare because it's just basically watching. It's probably what it feels like to have English as a second language. You know what I mean? Because you're just like, what the hell is going on here? This is so stupid. And the whole epic of the fact that it's like, oh, no, this is a man who's able to take the most complex human emotions and put them into the most beautiful poetry that's relatable to everyone. Like, Shakespeare is next to God for writing, obviously, but it's just so missed, and it's such a missed opportunity. So then it's really exciting when you do meet actors who do like classical theater and who are trained, because I mean, I don't know, the reason we started doing it in New Orleans is because there's so little classical theater there. There's been an uprising of theater basically after Katrina to rebuild the city. They brought in all these tax credits so that movies could be made there. I'm sorry, this is such a long-winded answer.
This is excellent.
All these actors moved in because if you're an actor there, you can get hired as a local hire. And the movie gets a tax write-off, and they get local talent because there wasn't a lot of trained actors there. And so, I don't know, this girl, Julie, and I, because she trained it at Skidmore. I think it's in Ohio. And so we were just talking about that. And it's just like, if you, I think the thing about Shakespeare is that actors get really excited to do it because it's the most exciting thing that you can do. The relationships are the most exciting thing, but there's not necessarily an audience for it. Yeah. So that's why there's so many twists in America of like drunk Shakespeare, you know, like all of these things.
Star and
so that's
Wars what we're Shakespeare as well.
Yeah, exactly. Or like, do you know Sleep No More?
No, I'm not too familiar with it.
Oh, it's this really amazing immersive theater thing in New York that's been going on for, I want to say 15 years. It might be more, it might be less. But it's basically like a giant warehouse that they've dedicated to this Shakespeare performance, and all these actors are playing different characters, and you are taken through with different characters through their plot lines. So you're not seeing the full play. You're just seeing it from this character's point of view. Mm. And so there's been like kind of a resurgence of kind of like a more virtual reality Shakespeare in America. So,
interesting.
Yeah. So I guess that was how we went about it. That was so long winded. I'm sorry.
No, at all. So like, obviously Shakespeare is something you're so passionate about. What was that at Shakespeare? What kind of motivated you to become an actor? What was the kind of the genesis for you?
Well, so I grew up in LA. So my parents worked in film. You're surrounded by people in film, so you. I think that there's a wonderful element of being someplace where people are actually making a living, doing mm-hmm. creative things, because you think of it as a possibility. And then from a really young age, I was a really avid reader, just like voraciously consumed books. And I think that there's a commonality between a lot of actors of not of selfishly wanting all of the lives,
uh-huh.
like wanting to be able to be a top chef and wanting to be able to be like a farmer or a crime investigator, and you want to be able to imbibe in all of the different human experiences. And in one life, the only way you can do that is by acting. And like the whole, I mean, I studied psych and neuroscience in college, and the fact that like, but for the grace of God go I, basically, is the whole thing when you're seeing a play. You know, like you see a Sam Shepard play, and you're like, well, I would never be in an incestual relationship. But the thing is, we're just not in that situation. Yeah. And we can all still relate to the emotions of it. And it's just like, it, I don't know, actors in theater just are the, it's like the church of humanity. You go there to see yourself. And being able to act that out is such a privilege.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's something like I always just kind of marvel at, like, all the different backgrounds people come from. And like, yeah, you're right. Being an actress, you get to play all these different amazing roles, and like obviously with your career as well, like you seem to have quite a diverse set of roles kind of so early on in your career. So kind of what was your kind of your big break, and like that you felt, oh my god, I think I'm gonna make it here as an actor?
Oh my god, have I had a break yet? I don't even think so. I don't think I feel even that I do. I feel constantly insecure of if I'm gonna be able to continue acting.
Uh huh.
I have really severe imposter syndrome constantly. Of like, well, I'm not going to be able to do this. But I think, because you're such a cinephile and you like follow all these things that like, I don't know, I think it's a series of moving goalposts. I think being on a set for the first time, like a real set where I was working there, not just like, you know, when I was young, mm-hmm. I'd go with my father to check up on sets because he does insurance for films, so he's the worst person to have on your set, but it was exciting still to go. Was I guess exciting, like, oh, this is a move. And then being able, I don't know, I honestly don't feel like there is a point yet where I've had a break. I'm hoping that this film that we're doing right now does, but it's just like, you know, anything, everything, nothing sure until it's over.
Mm-hmm. So it must be quite surreal when you're kind of going on to these like sets, like obviously you've been on like sort of the Scream TV series, NCIS, you know, and Demon, where like you're, you know, working with these big names, these big kind of talents. Like, what is that? Is that like, is it become something like a normal experience to be on these sets? Or is it always like, oh my God, there's Elle Fanning, or there's kind of, I don't know who the main star of NCIS is, New Orleans. I've lost track of how many spin-offs there are of that. Is it always kind of like, does it always kind of blow your mind, or does it become something where it's like, oh, this is my day job now?
I think it always feels exciting, and it's always a privilege. I just did, on Monday, I did a TV show called American Housewife.
Okay.
which I'd never heard of. It's a CBS show, but it's like super sitcom-y, super cute. And you get there, yeah, and you're like, it's always exciting. It's always thrilling. I think the thing that's super amazing about it, especially because film and TV are such different beasts and the sets are so different, is that it feels like, I mean, the thing that's like Neon Demon was so dope because you're watching these amazingly talented creative minds work and you feel like, oh my God, I should get kicked out of here instead of being able to watch like a fly on the wall with certain things and watching the way people, you know, go through their processes. It's just, it's thrilling. I hope it never isn't thrilling or nerve-wracking.
So how did you kind of end up on, say, like, the Neon Demon there? Like, how does someone get cast in, like, a Nicholas Winding Refn movie? Like, I just can't imagine what he must be like to work alongside or just to watch in action. How did that kind of all come around for you? How did you go from doing Shakespeare, kind of New Orleans, to being in LA on this, like, much-hyped, heralded movie?
Well, so I moved down to New Orleans for some parts because there was a huge film incentive down there, and I started working with an agent down there and was doing a lot of auditions for different things there, and I have a friend in LA who works in film who I had kind of like been sending my reel to, sending auditions to, just to get their feedback, and they were friends with one of the producers on it, and so they forwarded all my information, and which I didn't know at the time. And then I got called in to audition for a role that was too old for me. It was like one of the first women that Elle Fanning talks to, who's like, mm-hmm. Yeah, you can model, but are you going to do it? And so it was, you know, everything's just a stroke of luck. And so I flew back to LA for the audition because I was like, I'll just pretend I'm here. I'll do anything. And then I didn't get that, but then they called me back for another role in it. And it was just a series of fortunate events. And also, I think, of throwing everything in, you know what I mean? Of being like, yeah, no, I'll do anything. I'll be anywhere. Which is this whole industry. You just have to, it's a gypsy trade still.
What was it like when you were kind of like on set? Like, what kind of actors did you cross paths with? And did you have much interacting with Refn himself?
Yeah, he is wild to watch work. Yeah. So he basically never cut. He was filming the entire, well, thank God for digital, I guess. He was just filming the entire time. And there's, you know, it's interesting. I used to talk with my dad about the feeling of being on different sets and when you're working with certain directors. Like, anytime anyone signs up for a Steven Spielberg movie, there's this, like, energy that they bring to it because there's this maybe subconscious thing of like, oh, this could be an award-winning film. Like, this could be something amazing. Even if he's doing some, like, you know, like, BFG kid thing. And I'd never been on a set where there was an intent energy from every single person on that. And the world, because you create worlds, whatever, you're doing this thing, but the world of that he, it's, have you seen Neon Demon?
I have, and we covered it on the website. It was probably one of my top five movies of that year. I absolutely loved it, I must say. I loved it. I've got a blog up on the website about it. So, yeah, you don't have to worry about me blowing smoke up your arse on this one. I loved it.
Well, so you know how it's like this really weird, pounding kind of world that you're like sucked into, yeah. But kind of feel like, oh, God, what? But it also kind of feels like it's like claustrophobic in a way, like mm-hmm. It's closing in on you. That was a tangible, like, he just made, I mean, the whole thing that we were shooting was all on a soundstage, so it was just, like, pitch black, and he only had neon lights lighting up the interior of the soundstage, mm-hmm. And he just created this world and this palpable thing that was, like, everyone was on board for this ride, and he would go up to every single actor and just, like, talk them, which is really interesting, because I don't know, people are just also different, people go around things different ways, but he just talked them into it, and it was kind of, like, I mean, it's exceedingly intimate the way he talks to people because he's really getting into that character's psyche, mm-hmm. And it's like watching the character, not the actor, but that specific character be in a therapy session almost of like going through all of their like inner turmoil, inner thoughts, and all of these underlying things that are playing into the mm-hmm. scene. in a really personal, interesting way. Because, I mean, all directors are different, and I've worked with directors who are like, so why are you saying this? And why are you saying this? And we want more of this. And, like, make it more windy or whatever. I mean, that's the whole thing. But, like, it felt like what it looked like. And I think that only came together because he has such a vision. And he is, God, I can't imagine being a director. It's so much work. But he just got every single crew member, every single cast member on board with that, and was, you know, create. And he had this really weird, like, Swedish dance club music that he played between every take. So there was just, it was unrelenting, but in a, I mean, that's how you get a good piece.
And was it kind of a nerve-wracking experience? Obviously, you were saying he goes around each of the different actors and kind of whispers, like, these sort of counseling sessions in their ear. Like, when he was coming around to yourself, were you like, what was your kind of feeling? And what kind of, do you remember anything that he sort of said to you for your role?
Well, we did, like, an improv session because some of the lines he wanted to switch up. I remember, and he was, like, he was wonderful. He kicked everyone out of the soundstage except for me and Elle Fanning and this other actress. And was like, okay, just improv it. We know, like, the thing, the scene, let's improv, I want new lines. And it was, I mean, your stomach drops out of you, like, which is so annoying because you get to do all this improv training. But let's see, what did he say? I mean, he just kind of, there's not like a noteworthy quote out of it, but just kind of creates the pressure and the space, I guess, of, like, being like, this is what you want, this is what you're doing, like, go get it. It's really, I mean, I'll bet it's different for each different film he does, but for that, it's kind of like a weird puppety movie also, you know, like a puppet master thing. And I think he created that.
Was it quite a surreal experience to see, like, this movie that you'd starred in, like, it gets broadcast all around the world, everyone always has an opinion on a Refn movie, and then to see yourself on that kind of big screen with Elle Fanning in a Nicholas Winding Refn movie?
Well, I wouldn't say I starred in it by any means, but I mean, yeah, it's fantastic. Well, I mean, I think a thing that happens with any movie is that you can't see a movie fully, and especially, I mean, it's a cinematographer's art and the editor's art and the director's art, and you're not shooting it, you know, chronologically. And so then seeing the final product and seeing what the cameras took out of everything. Because if you're on a soundstage, if you're on anywhere, you know, you have so much cast and crew and you just don't necessarily have an exact idea of what this shot is and what is being like percolating through it. And it's astounding. It's always awe-inspiring. And yeah, it's dope to be like, oh my God, I was part of that to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, I'm insanely jealous. I don't think I'll ever get the chance to star in one of his movies. And yeah, I loved the Neon Demon. It was just, to this day, I still remember that eyeball scene like it was yesterday. It's a classic modern movie, I think.
It's amazing.
So then, kind of after the Neon Demon, like, what kind of, where did you kind of sort of go after that? That obviously you've got a few exciting projects coming up, you know, working with people like Bryan Cranston, for example, and you've got your own kind of projects. After the Neon Demon, where did you decide to go with your kind of career from there?
Well, let's see. After Neon Demon, I did a movie that I think it was kind of a straight to DVD movie, but it was, or I guess straight to VHS, I don't know, whatever it is, VCR now, I think they changed the name of it now, but it was called at the time, I'm Wrath, which is like a very action movie with,
John Travolta.
John Travolta, thank you. I wanted to say Frank Sinatra, which is completely wrong. But John Travolta, which was in Ohio, which was fun to go and be able to work on that. And then I did another movie called Loners, where I got to work with Stephen Tobolowsky, who's a genius.
I met him last year. What was it like working with him? Because that's actually, if you look yourself up on IMDb, you've got all your kind of your headshots, and there's this picture of you two together in the back of a car. Like, I met him last year at the Fringe, actually. And Yeah, I spoke with him and I was like, oh, I loved you in Californication. Is it okay if I get like a photo? He's like, yeah, of course. Wait a second, I've got my jacket from the set. Let me go off and get it and we'll wear that in the photo. And he could not have been a nicer guy. Like, what was your experience of working with him? Please don't say he was terrible and horrible.
He was the most dramatic. He was fantastic. He's just so cool. He's just so cool. He's so whip smart and so funny. And like my ideal sense of humor of just kind of that like dry, sarcastic witticism. Mm-hmm. And that was a really low budget movie that was a passion project of these two actors and this playwright. And they'd done it as a play and then they wanted to make it into a feature because it just got so many accolades as a play in Los Angeles. So they did it super low budget. I think it was the director was this really, really cool guy who'd mainly done music videos. I think it might've been one of his first features, and Steven was nothing but, I mean, he's so legendary compared to every single, all of us, we were like, ah, and he was the coolest person, made everyone feel so at ease, was just telling me, in between all the takes, hilarious stories. So he has a podcast called The Tobolowsky Files, which he's just had a crazy life, all the craziest experiences happened to him, but he also can tell good stories, which, you know, they say great stories happen to those who can tell them because it's hard to, like, think about them in that way. So he was just telling hilarious stories and really good at banter, and then it made it really comfortable for when we got on set to do our scenes when we were actually rolling. It was so nice to feel comfortable and have a repartee with him already, because he knows that he's sitting there and he's like done such great work, and I'm sure he knows like, okay, this might be intimidating for people, and just being able to like drop any kind of facade and just be so present. He's also, and I think this is something with people that are successful, is that he's so present, you know, which is hard to do, especially because of Instagram and iPhones and everything.
Yeah. Because when I met him, like, that was his show at the Fringe was like him just, it was sort of similar to his kind of podcast. He was just like telling stories of his life, like with his family, you know, being on set. And you were just kind of sat there and you just, I remember, I think we were like the second row. And I remember just having my mouth just in awe of him, like just listening to these stories and like, oh my God, this guy is, as you say, has lived a life. And he's, you know, I couldn't imagine kind of meeting a nicer guy or probably working with a nicer guy. He seemed, you know, first class.
Yeah, no, he's wonderful. Do you watch Silicon Valley?
I've watched the first season. I've not got beyond that. I did enjoy what I'd seen, though.
It's funny. I mean, there's no women on it basically at all, which I find really frustrating and upsetting. But he's hilarious.
It was always Californication I loved him from. I thought he was fantastic as Stu, the movie producer with a sexual appetite, that's for sure.
I've never seen Californication. I should watch it.
Oh, yeah. If you ever want to see one of your like fellow co-stars having sex with a puppet, a blown-up doll, that's the TV show for you. He comes in a bit...
Why would you not want to see that?
He comes in about midway through the run, and he's brilliant. He's in almost every episode. Him and David Duchovny are just incredible together.
Yeah, well, David Duchovny is amazing as well. Yeah, I need to watch it. My roommates in college were obsessed with it. I need to. There's just so much content now.
Oh yeah, it's finding the time to watch these things, like the new movies and shows and podcasts. It's so hard to be on top of everything or commit to something these days. So it's like when like something like Games of Thrones comes along, it feels like an anomaly that everyone loves this one show and can make the time to watch it, I think.
I know. Tonight's the last episode. Are you watching it?
I've only watched season one, so I'm that far behind. So I figure I'm going to watch it all before it comes back for the final run. Like, I did that with Lost, so I'm going to do that with this.
Oh, my God. You know, I didn't get to the end of Lost, because in the first three episodes, I was like, they're dead.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. You've saved yourself a whole watching it. If you're listening to this show, like, years on from Lost's finishing, apologies for the spoilers.
So, like, oh, yeah, sorry, spoilers. but Game of Thrones is just amazing. I'm jealous that you have all that to catch up
with. Oh, yeah, and I'm jealous of you in Californication, so maybe in a year's time we'll podcast again. And
we'll check back up.
Yeah, the lessons we've learned from these movies. And, like...
Yeah, it's crazy, too, because they are movies. They're not TV shows now. Mm-hmm. I mean, tonight's going to be probably over an hour. And it's this bigger budget than a lot of movies. The special effects, it's just amazing.
Well, you've still got like a season left of it to be released, so you can maybe try and squeeze yourself into a wee role in there as well.
God, can you imagine? That would be so fantastic.
And
that would be so cool.
And you've got like another movie that caught my eye that's coming up called The Upside, with Bryan Cranston, Nicole Kidman, and a Paul Feig movie who I love from Freaks and Geeks. How did you get involved with that movie, and what was it like to work on that with such amazing names?
Well, how did I get involved with that? That right after grad school, we did audition. We had showcases in New York and Los Angeles for our graduating class, and some people came out to see, you know, managers and agents come out, and somebody came out to see it and sent me sides for like an audition, basically for a role in that, and I went when we were in New York to read for the role, and then ended up being called back to read for a different role. And then I got to go to Philadelphia for the first time ever when we were shooting that. And it was cool because I got to meet Bryan Cranston, who I've never met, who I'm a huge fan of. Through everything, I mean, I'm a fan of Malcolm in the Middle, and he's a genius on that show. And it's so cool to be like, oh, that's not who you are. Because when he was in that, I think that there was kind of like a feeling of, oh, this is who this person is. But it's like, no, he's just an amazing actor. And that wasn't just a one-off. Mm-hmm. He can do anything. He's just so smart. Do you know the premise of that movie right now?
Yeah, Sarah? Just sort of like it's about a kind of a dog show, like a police dog, and it goes undercover.
No, that's a different movie. That's Show Dogs.
Ah. Oh, no, what? Yeah, I've got the wrong one up here, sorry.
Arnett.
Oh, yeah, I mean, he's Akira, sorry. Yeah, I've got the two mixed up there.
Yeah, I know, because it's Kevin Hart. Kevin Hart's in the one with Bryan Cranston, which is a remake of the French film L'Intouchable, which I'm probably pronouncing right, which is about a billionaire, basically, who's paraplegic, and he hires a new caregiver, a new carer, to take care of him, which is played in this one by Kevin Arnett. And they end up forming, you know, an unlikely bond, and it's really amazing. And then it's kind of like seeing into these two different worlds and who these people are because of their situations versus who they are once the situations are changed. Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, the French film is seamless. It's fantastic. And then to remake it with all of these fantastic actors and bring it to a huge American audience is going to be really exciting.
Especially with it being a Paul Feig movie, like that comes with like a stamp of like absolute class. That, you know, I mean, there's some of those movies I've never sort of maybe clicked with, but like he's got a free pass for life for Freaks and Geeks, and absolutely for that.
Well, that's something that's going to be really interesting about it, is that it's bringing together a lot of talent that have a lot of different fan bases.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to unite, I think. It's going to be interesting to see the different people that go to see it, because it's, you know, they're all really different. From Kevin Hart to Bryan Cranston even is a hugely different fan base, because, you know, they've done different work.
Yeah, it must be so surreal, like, kind of, to be working with, like, Bryan Cranston, like, you know, no actor's probably more famous in the world for kind of his television roles in particular and everything, like, to be like, oh, that was the guy from Malcolm in the Middle, like, I would find that so surreal to just be kind of working alongside him.
Yeah, well, he was so lovely also. I mean, he just immediately makes everyone feel at ease, was joking, knew every single, I mean, it was a big movie, it was a really big budget, big movie, tons of people on set, knew every single person's name, was comfortable with everyone, joking with everyone, but still, like, good work ethic, and just a lovely human, someone that you're like, oh my god, be my uncle, come over for dinner, sort of thing. So it was a pleasure. He was really lovely.
And then obviously, we kind of touched on it, like Show Dogs, that sounds like quite an interesting one, that Stanley Tucci, I met him at the film festival recently, was such a nice guy, and obviously Scottish Alan Cumming, Will Arnett, mm-hmm. Like, how did you get involved in this one? This sounds like quite an interesting movie.
That I got involved with through a family friend was producing it, Deepak, who produced... he produced I need more coffee yesterday. With Bend It Like Beckham, and he's done a number of really interesting films. And so this one, he was producing, and I had just gone out of grad school and was hounding him for things. And so he had me read for one of the parts. And it was a pretty small part I read for, and then I ended up getting it. But then when I got there, the director, Raja, who's so cool and funny, just started having Will Arnett and I improv.
Uh-huh.
And so I got to just improv with Will Arnett, who's just like...
So jealous right now.
Yeah, it was amazing because he just... It's like playing tennis with Serena Williams or something, where you just have to be... He just kept hitting it back so quickly and was so smart. But then there's also just a dog standing in between us that we had to interact with, which was hilarious. And I'd never done an animal movie before. And to see how the trainers get the dogs to do all of the expressions and everything was hilarious. Because they just stand behind the camera, basically, with a tennis ball and move it around behind the camera so that the dog's eyebrows are moving.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but that was really fun. And it was in Las Vegas, which I'd never been to, which was a really interesting, weird place.
Uh-huh. It's certainly, I can't imagine what it must be like to kind of, like, I would probably, my mind would have been blown just standing opposite Will Arnett, like, kind of improvising, and I find it hard not to think of him as Joe, probably, from Arrested Development, and quoting his lines at him, like, oh, like, moments like that must be kind of, you know, so special to experience.
Oh, yeah, you want to live in it forever when you're in it. Like, you just don't want it to end. Yeah, I mean, it was really surreal, because it was just, I mean, I'm a huge Arrested Development fan. Are they making a movie of it?
They're making a new season, a fifth season. So, that's kind of kicking off. It's going to be on Netflix again. So, yeah, it's officially happening, but it'll probably be next year before we get it.
Yeah. Do you know if it's going to be an isolated character one, like the last one?
No, I think they've said they've learned from the mistakes of that kind of pretty poor Netflix season they started off with. So I've got high hopes for this one. Hopefully it's as good as the first couple of seasons.
Oh my gosh, I would love to rewatch all of it before that. Yeah, I mean,
I'm sure I will.
He's so smart. He's just he's hilarious. Comedic timing is really interesting, and different people's type of comedic timing is really interesting. And he's really his own breed. And so it was amazing. It was an amazing experience. I'm so grateful to have had that. I hope I would get to work with him again.
And one thing,
he's just a genius.
Yeah. Like, one thing I'm just kind of so fascinated about by is that obviously we've spoken about kind of working with like Will Arnett, Bryan Cranston, Refn, Fanning, all these amazing things. How did you kind of go from all these roles and now you've just finished a Kickstarter project for a movie called Big Sur? Do you want to tell us a bit about that, how it all kind of came around? And because that it just blows my mind that this seems like a hell of a project you're taking on here.
Let's see, where to begin with this? So we used to go to Sundance every year as a family because my dad worked in the industry. And when I was 16, I went to the Shorts festival there, just to one of the, and there was a ton of amazing films. And there was this one Chinese short film that was, it was only like 18 minutes long or something. And it was about this girl, so little dialogue, this girl on this bus, and who's basically attacked, and everybody sort of stands by and is a bystander, like a Kitty Genovese sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
And it has a really interesting kind of twist ending and reveal, and it's really interesting in terms of character, because if you have all these people in an isolated, you know, you're isolated on this bus, and so it's the whole thing that that Joan Didion talks about, of like group scenes show us character morals.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a perfect short. And I had just moved into the place I'm living right now in Highland Park in Los Angeles. And both of my roommates are filmmakers. And I was kicking around the idea with one of them of making a short, because like as an actor, you basically, I mean, at least I always feel kind of out of control of my career, and like nothing is certain. You get a gig and it's great, and you're like, okay, what is the next thing going to be? When is the next thing? And I'm a very obsessive, anxious little middle child. So I'm like, okay, I need to be creating my own work.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were talking about shorts and movies and what to do. And I was talking to him about my roommate, Eddie Liguori, who's done a ton of TV, about what to do about this short and how I'd love to do something like that. And then we couldn't think of anything better than it. So I got in touch with the woman who had originally made it as her MFA thesis film from CalArts. Her name is Juan Jiang, and I'm butchering the name. and got the rights from her to remake it and make an American adaptation. Because it's a fantastic short, but it is culturally bound. Because uh-huh. they're uh-huh. a collectivist culture. We are an individualistic culture. And there aren't guns in China, supposedly. You're not allowed to film crime in China, which is also really amazing that she made the short at all. Mm-hmm. And because she went to school here and she works here now, but she did make it in China. So then my roommate, Maddie, she does line producing for Paramount TV, and she's like, okay, well, I'll just have you make a budget for it. Like, see if you could actually do it. So I wrote an adaptation of it. She helped me make up a budget, and I was like, okay, I can do this whole thing I can do it for relatively cheap. Got the Kickstarter going, and, I don't know. I guess it was a lot of just like post the election in America mm-hmm. coming, because I was in London for Brexit and it was just like, oh God, the world is ending.
Yeah, I can relate to that feeling.
Yeah. And then coming back here and having the election and feeling so out of control and feeling like we're going back into like Civil War era America and all of these really ugly parts of humanity are being brought back. I mean, you know, what just happened in Charlottesville.
Yeah.
And I'd gone to the Women's March in Washington with my mother and my sister the day after the inauguration, Trump's inauguration. And I was just like, I need to be making something, because sexism is so rampant. And I know there's a lot of other issues and there's a lot of intersectionality within feminism. But just like the fact that bystander effect is so prevalent in America, and it's so wrongly termed bystander effect, because what it really is sexism. Mm-hmm. Because if you see, like with Kitty Genovese in 1950s in New York, there was so much justification in the neighbors' heads of, well, it's probably a lover's spat, or like, what, she might have done something to deserve this. And it's the whole thing of, if you're a female college student and you get drunk and your laptop gets stolen, cops fill out a report. If you get drunk and your car gets broken into, cops fill out a report. Home invasion, cops fill out a report. You get drunk and you get raped, and they're like, well, what were you wearing? Yeah. And it's like, yeah, like, no, that's completely erroneous to this. And I just read a Rebecca Solnit book right before I'd started the adaptation called The Mother of All Questions, and she talks about shame and how sexual, like, after sexual abuse or rape or sexual assault of any kind, the shame is on the victim, which is so... it's so backwards, because the fact that somebody who's experienced something is the one that has to kind of like incarcerate it within themselves and is the one that has to trudge through it constantly in court. Meanwhile, the person who's done the act isn't shamed by our society, really. Mm-hmm. Where like, if you're murdered, it's not shameful and embarrassing that you got murdered. Uh-huh. And yet there's so much of this really just horrible rhetoric surrounding, like sexual assaults in America, and America really is a rape culture in so many ways. And I just kind of was obsessing over that. And this piece really deals with that in a really amazing way. And I just wanted to show, I mean, people act out in this short and I don't think that anyone's acting properly, but just kind of show that like, we're all a part of everything. And if you're going to live in a society, then you have to take responsibility for all the members of it. There's no reason to be a nation otherwise.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting too, because there's such a call for nationalism right now, and yet it's for basically like white men's protection more than anything else, which is just ridiculous.
Because I was reminded when I was reading up on the project about the bystander effect. Like, I used to work in kind of universities and kind of colleges, and it's taught there, the bystander effect. And it's always interesting when you watch a classroom get told about the bystander effect in Kitty Genovese, where it's like, people like are shocked, like, how is that possible? How did that kind of happen? It's such a weird reaction to watch like a whole classroom act like, oh my God, this is an unthinkable thing. But then you see it happen every day, that you see something, say, in Charlottesville or whatever, for example, some people are being assaulted and some people's first reaction is just to film it as opposed to kind of go to someone's aid. It's so horrible, and it's so relevant to nowadays. Yeah, it sounds like you're on the ball with this project.
It's exciting to be making it. I mean, but it's also just like, So Kitty Genovese happened in the 1950s, and it's still the case that everyone points to, like what you're saying in college courses. 3 months ago, a teenage girl was raped in Chicago, and it was live streamed. And if you're watching that on Facebook on your live stream, you are condoning it. You're mm-hmm. a part of it, you know? And there's so many things like that. I mean, it's like there was also that autistic girl who was, I want to say Chicago for that as well, who was raped by a bunch of football players. It's just revolting that this is happening in our society and is clickbait rather than from a young age there being a level of morality mm-hmm. and like understanding that everybody, you know, an independent person kind of isn't being taught.
Because I think of when it was last year where there was the black individual had been shot in a car, and like that was being live streamed to the internet, and everyone's just like tuning in, like people are watching it, like either concerned, or there's a lot of people are probably going, oh my god, someone's been shot in a car, like clicking a few buttons and watching a live stream of someone essentially dead in a car. And it was such a surreal experience. It seemed to sum up where we are as a kind of culture so well. It's torn between people that are tuning in to care and champion someone's civil rights, and then on the other side, there's people kind of egging it on, watching it as just something so shocking.
Yeah, isn't that fascinating? There's also this really in the script, the director, who's amazing, Alexis Korysinski, and I've really been searching for areas that social media can be portrayed in it, because there's also this weird thing, like what you're talking about, of a removal because of a screen and witnessing something through a screen and not understanding that it's still an authentic experience that the person on the other side of it's having, mm-hmm. and they're not feeling responsible because of that. And like we're so removed because everything's filtered through our phones and through technology, but it's astounding that certain things are still happening. And it is good, on the other hand, that like there is an avail. If it wasn't for Twitter, there's a lot of things that we wouldn't be seeing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
And obviously, it's so great that like your projects clearly kind of resonate with people. It's hit its total. So what's happening now for the movie? What's kind of going to be the production process, and when can we all expect to see this movie?
Well, so Alexis, the director, is filming two pilots right now. She's fantastic and in high demand in Canada, and she gets back next month, and then our shooting dates are November, we're just shooting it in 3 days, I think November 9th, 10th, and 11th are our projected shooting dates, and then it's just post, so hopefully, I mean, I know that we miss a lot of the deadlines for film festivals, but hopefully in the next 4 to 5 months, we'll have a finished product.
That'd be awesome. Hopefully, maybe we'll see you here in the Edinburgh Film Festival getting to premiere it here, and hopefully we can get you back on the show and find out how the whole process went. So if people wanted to kind of follow like the process of making this movie, or kind of, you know, reach out to you and find out about your work, where would be like kind of the best places to find that?
Well, God, that makes me realize that we need to make a website for the movie. It's my first time producing anything, uh-huh. also, so I'm just kind of like going by the skin of my teeth.
As long as you've got a MySpace page, I'm sure you'll be fine.
I do have a MySpace page. You can also always follow everything and reach out to me on Instagram, which is just at Madeline Woolner. And there's a contact thing on there. As for the project, I will make a website for it soon. This is such a good reminder. And I will post that as a link probably in my Instagram. It's not MySpace page, it's a Facebook page.
Okay.
Sorry. Which is at Madeline Woolner, and that should be updated with everything.
Cool.
And
we'll share all these notes in the kind of the show notes for on our webpage as well. So if anyone's listening to this, they can kind of click on that as well. So we'll make sure to put that in there too.
Okay, perfect. Well, I guess that would be it. And then I'll send you as soon as we have the link to the website up. If you want to stick that on,
yeah,
anything.
Perfect. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on, and good luck with your project.
So
it's been a real pleasure to talk to you today.
Oh no, the pleasure is all mine. I'm so happy this worked out. Have a lovely evening.
Yeah, the same to you. And as I say, hopefully we'll have you again, perhaps on in the future. And yeah, thank you so much for everything. I really appreciate you talking to us on a Sunday.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerdpod.